the national citizenship. Within the PLO, there are all sorts of ideas and ideologies, etc. They debate like everybody else. But the framework is peoplehood. And the PLO, like the Jewish Agency at one time, it was not elected. It assumed a historical role and secured the loyalty of its adherents. By the same token, the Palestinians adhere to the PLO, not because they have elected them, but because the PLO assumed the historical responsibility of bringing national dignity and freedom to the Palestinian people, an urge which is universally shared by the Palestinian people.
Let me preface this by saying that I'm, as a Jew and a Zionist, one who left America to live in Israel. And I'm also a Zionist actively involved in the Israeli peace movement. And I also want to preface this by saying there are humanistic Zionists, like myself, I think, who believe that, like the Jewish people who can't maintain their Jewish nationhood, the Palestinians can't maintain their Palestinian nationhood without a homeland. That one of the biggest battles we have to fight is a battle towards peace. With both people, the Jews not only as a religion but also as a people, the Palestinians as a people, both requiring states, have to make peace. And that fear is probably the biggest thing, as Sadat said, in making that peace. And what I wanted to voice to you as an activist in the Israeli peace movement is that our biggest battle in Israel is fighting that fear amongst Israelis, that psyche amongst Israelis that you can't understand. You mentioned three principles on which the peace should be grounded: the UN conference, the Israeli withdrawal from 67, and the Palestinian state, or recognition of the PLO, maybe a fourth precondition. They are preconditions. I'm willing to accept those preconditions. I think there are a lot of Israelis who would be willing to accept those preconditions. But I think there's one precondition that's missing there, and that you still fail to answer when this gentleman asked his question, about the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state within secure and recognized boundaries, if those boundaries are 67, okay. I guess what I'm asking is, you talk about a structure in which this peace has to exist. But how can you expect to change those fears or to help those Israelis, those Zionists who are humanistic and looking towards the establishment of coexistence between two people, with both of whom have legitimate rights to a homeland? How can you expect us to change that Israeli psyche when dignitaries like yourself don't help us by talking about a structure or preconditions, which include one very important precondition to us, which is the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state within recognized boundaries, even those from 67. And I ask you straightforward, can you accept that?
Well, first of all, when I said that the conditions of peace is for Israel to withdraw to the 1967 borders, I suppose this is a definition of the Israeli state within 1967 borders. Now, if we go into more semantics about it.
The Jewish state.
Yeah. The Jewish fears. I don't want to elaborate on these matters, but I will because of the time frame, because this is an important question and I want to address it. much of the... You see, we are juxtaposing two kinds of fears. The genuine fear of Palestinians and the Arabs, but Palestinians in particular, in this case, having to shoulder the historic responsibility of a problem they did not create. Let us assume the validity that there is a need for a Jewish state to anchor Jewish fears and hopes and etc. The locus which has been chosen at the expense of the systematic disfranchisement of the Palestinians from their homes has been reconciled to by the Palestinians. They know they are carrying the brunt of a situation to which they have not contributed. This is basically a problem which the northern part of the globe, Soviet Union, Germany, Western Europe, America, part of that is the problem. Palestinians came to this problem because the Zionist organization, which you have said that you chose Palestine to be the ultimate homeland for spiritual, historical, whatever reasons. I'm not arguing the reasons. In a way, the Palestinian presence interrupted the unraveling of this process. It interrupted. So after, this is what I come back to, after the Israeli state reconciled with the Western world, don't ask me any question, I don't ask you any question, we, the Arabs and the Palestinians, became the inheritors in the psyche, which you're talking about, in the Israeli psyche, we became the inheritors of those who have caused persecution. We have not related to that experience. Don't expect us to relate.
Practically, it's important.
Well, I mean, I know, but I mean, it's important to that you recognize the theoretical distinction. We are in the Israeli psyche, the incarnates of a possible recurrence of the Holocaust. But we're not. We perceive of ourselves as the victims of a solution where we have been transformed from human beings to human obstacles in the unraveling of the so-called Israeli state. This is a problem that you have to penetrate if you want us to understand the ethos of your fears. That's an important issue. The second issue is that you must therefore concede for the Palestinians. You can ask them politically to recognize Israel, the state, within the 67 borders. But you can't ask them to recognize the right of Israel. Because by recognizing the right of Israel, they have almost declared that they had no right to be in Palestine for the last 1600 years. So it's not, the right can develop later on by the increments of confidence, but you don't ask it as a precondition. You can extract from the Palestinians, because of the asymmetry in power, a recognition of the state of Israel within the 1967 borders, and the recognition by Israel of the Palestinians, also in the West Bank and Gaza. Then, historically, in retrospect, you might develop whereby the mutual fears are removed, and the question of right and wrong becomes subliminal. And it is a very important issue. Because unless we come to grip with the Palestinian psyche, they are called upon to carry the brunt of a historical incident of which they did not take part, nor did they share. They have been targeted to as the human obstacles to this established state. The established state was made possible by a reconciliation between the West and the Zionists. And then what we do, we ask, where do you want to stop this Israel? Where is its borders? So that we can have our own borders. No answer. As long as the Israelis do not claim or do not recognize that West Bank and Gaza are occupied territories, therefore they are a claimant to these territories. Hence the fear, the genuine fear of the Palestinians. Hence the uprising. Hence setting in motion the corrective. So as you ask us to come to grips, the Palestinians feel that they have more to fear than the nuclear-equipped Israel today. They have the fear, as a matter of fact, they have they are so volatile. They have witnessed experience in the refugee camps. They have been bombarded. They have been knocked out. And you take the asymmetry again. I must emphasize this. The Palestinians, every day, 4 or 5 are killed, 10 are killed, yesterday 15 are killed. They're faceless, nameless.
16.
When one Israeli girl was killed, she had a name. She became an issue. And then, when it was disclosed that it was the settlers, because the settlers in the occupied territories, are they the precursors of an expanded Israel? That is the question that the Israelis must answer. And then when she was killed accidentally, yet the fact that she was killed by one of her own was a prejudice interrupted. The question that I ask you is, are these the precursors of the new Israel? Or who are they? They are tomorrow what you're saying today. They will have their own fears of living in a sea of Arabs that have to be emptied. These settlements would have to be protected. The 6 settlements or 16 settlements in the Golan Heights have to be protected. When does this end? So the issue is not that we are insensitive to genuine fears, but we are intending to confront, put up paranoias. Same thing as Mr. Botha, who's outflanked by his right wing in South Africa. He's afraid that his Christian values are being undermined by Tutu, who's another archbishop, but still, he's different. So it is high time. I am glad that you raised the question, because I think that unless you come to grips with a historical injustice, that we, the Arabs, are asking the Palestinians to reconcile to. We. The world community is asking the Palestinians to reconcile to the inevitability of their injustice. All what we are trying to do through the Palestinian state, through the international conference, is to mitigate the degree of injustice. Palestinians have been historically relegated that they cannot have total justice. And this ultimately, in the next century, is going to tell us, the Arabs, that we have, in the name of reconciliation, we compromised. But let it be. Let it be. Over there.
Masoud, you speak very eloquently about Palestinians, and I have questions regarding other refugees in the region, and those would be the Arab Jewish refugees. Between the years 1948 to 1956, there was a sizable minority of Arab Jews who subsequently had to move elsewhere. In your talk, you neglected this aspect, and I was wondering, as the ambassador of the Arab League, how would you speak about this in historical, cultural, and political terms?
Don't, as I said earlier, I don't want to paraphrase the past, but I'll spell out the future. I don't want to mention about Mossad operatives in the Haganah going and blowing synagogues in Baghdad in order to secure. Don't let me open this question, because it would be condemnatory to the whole history of Zionist movement. We are trying to get into an amnesia of memory, because if we reopen the issue, I want to know why the synagogues in Baghdad were blown up. Well, of course it has something to do. Of course it has something to do.
The chief rabbi of Baghdad did not support the Zionist movement in the 30s and into the 40s. I'm speaking specifically not about the Zionists, not about Israel, about the Jews in these countries and their lives that were interrupted and had to take on the status of a refugee in as much as the Palestinian Arabs, both Christian and Muslim themselves, had to. You can't shake your head, it's on the record.
Of course I can shake my head. When I know that the history is replete with the Lavon affair and with the Baghdad synagogues and others.
But wait a minute.
I'm not going to argue this point. I'm going to say one thing. We in the Arab world practice, unfortunately, discrimination. There has been instances when Christians discriminated against Muslims, when Muslims discriminated against Christians and Jews. But discrimination to us, it is like in the United States and in India, it's a problem. While discrimination in Israel and in South Africa is a policy. We are willing and able and open to allow any Jew of Arab extraction who wants to return. I declare this as an official policy. Let Israel say the same thing, that it would accept any Palestinian to return to his home. There was one before and then. Yes.
Yes, Rabbi Asser, what do you see as the United States' role in resolution of the situation gripping this area? And perhaps you, could you comment on the Scholz plan and its viability as a vehicle for this resolution?
I did comment before, but I'm willing to briefly spell them out. We think that the Scholz plan has been sensitized, Secretary Scholz, as a result of the uprising, has been sensitized to the significance of this uprising and tries to contain or curtail its consequences. The Scholz plan was sensitized to the need for an international conference, but which was divested of any functional or operational authority. So we object to that, although we recognize that he has accepted the concept of an international conference, and this gives room for more dialogue. We have said that we want to structure the outcome of negotiations, namely how to provide security for all the states, including Israel and Jordan and Syria and Palestine, etc., either through demilitarized zones or through any, or through UN presence or through international forces at the beginning, so that the sense of security, how to structure the withdrawal, how to structure the outcome of self-determination. So, in our view, we do not want to negotiate what is the ultimate status. The ultimate status is self-determination for the Palestinians and Israel withdrawal and security for all the states. So we differ on that. We differ on the fact that you don't choose Palestinians who are not representative of their people. And therefore, any attempt to circumvent the PLO as the mandated authority means that you're not serious, that there is no seriousness in negotiations. You negotiate. We would prefer to negotiate with Peace Now in Israel because they have a more sensible and sensitive policy and approach, and they understand. Unfortunately, they are not able to deliver. So we, if the outcome of elections is Mr. Shamir again, we cannot say, please get us Mr. Iban or somebody else. We cannot choose for Israel their representative. Israel cannot choose for the Palestinians their representatives, nor can the Americans. And so we differ with Mr. Schulz, but our differences are not so deep at this moment that they preempt further dialogue. So we're willing and open for a continuation of the dialogue. I don't think that after his veto, after the veto of the United States last Friday, on a rather innocuous resolution, I don't think that, I mean, it would be more of a loss of time to go now to the Arab countries. I mean, I think, in a way, the Scholz plan after the veto has been dealt a mortal blow. It has not been killed, but it has been dealt a mortal blow. If there is hospitalization in the next few months, perhaps.
Whenever you have an argument with an Israeli or any Israeli supporter. Now suppose that the Palestinians on the West Bank decided to elect a body to represent them. And that is, for example, the PLO. I'm sure you know the organizers, or the bones of the organizers of that election will be crushed immediately. And I remember just one incident in 1984, if my memory is right, you see, when the Palestinian parliament met in Amman. And there were representatives of the Palestinians coming from all over the world, except from the West Bank, the borders. You see, the bridge was closed. And nobody that was called, nobody, any representative that was called by the Palestinian parliament was allowed to cross the bridge to go and meet in Amman with the Palestinian parliament. On one hand, they tell you, you see, that this is a body that's not elected by you as Palestinians, and if we try to go out and elect them, we are just stopped, we are not allowed to cross the bridge. So you cannot know how to deal with this double standard, you see.
And whenever there is a leader among the Palestinians, they'll deport him in violation of the Geneva Convention. So
you cannot win with it.
Yes?
I was wondering why is it that the PLO can't just accept resolutions 242 and 238? 338, excuse me. And just accept those and then go for peace from there.
Well, we said that we accept, I mean, the PLO as well as the Arab states, we accept 242 and 338 as the determiner of the territorial patrimonies of both. But we consider it to be an incomplete, and it has to be complemented, because it treats the Palestinians not as a people but as refugees. And in that respect, we want them, there has been complementarity. There has been new resolutions which recognize for the Palestinians their right to self-determination. We accept 242 and the right of Palestinians to self-determination. That would secure the parameters of the settlement that we have always advocated. Yes?
When you say we need the Arabs, I wonder if you're talking on the behalf of Saddam Hussein, maybe Muammar Gaddafi, did they ever mumble very quietly? They are, in principle, willing to live together with, I mean, a two countries or two state solution. Did they ever mumble it? And the Arab
in the Fez resolutions of the Arab League summit, all the Arab states, including the PLO, which is a full member of the Arab League, have ratified the parameters which I have spelled out of a peaceful settlement.
Can that has a reference, for example, for Muammar Gaddafi saying that he's willing to
Well, we have. No. We have in the Arab world. I mean, the document that I'm speaking, because the Arab League represents the resultant consensus. We don't represent every individual state. What I am saying is that what I say, maybe some Arab states will not agree, but nobody disagrees with what I say. And that's important. So I do not, I mean, there is variations between Mr. Gaddafi and Mr. Saddam Hussein, Mr. Hafez al-Assad, Mr. Arafat, Mr. George Habash. There is variations. What happens is that within the framework of the Arab League, they meet, they argue, they fight, they kill, and they come and they say, you say, this is your broad outlines. Develop them in the United Nations or in Cornell University. So what I'm saying reflects the consensus of the Arab states. Does not mirror every particular opinion of every Arab state. No. But it represents what they have delegated to be what they agree upon.
Maksud, we have time for another like two or three questions. After that, we'll go to AD White House and then we can continue this discussion. So,
When I was in India, sorry, let me make it. When I was in India, there was I was younger than now, much younger and more dynamic. And so there was a meeting of Arab ambassadors. And there was a young chargé d'affaires of Lebanon who attended the meeting of Arab ambassadors for the first time. And something I said, somebody asked me a question of the Arab ambassadors, And I was answering. This young chargé d'affaires, meeting for the first time with such dignitaries, asked the Syrian ambassador, who's a leading poet, Omar Aburishi, asked him, that word he, Dr. Maksoud used, I didn't understand. In Arabic, he responded, please don't ask, he'll answer. He'll explain, he'll elaborate. So I don't want to do that. I'll make them very brief.
Right. But we promise that we have at least another hour in AD White House, so we can. But it'll be over drinks and food, so it's less.
You mentioned earlier about our presidential candidates. Do you see anybody amongst the people that are running that would have any sympathy for the situation, or are they just going to run around it as usual?
You know what, if an Arab gives his opinion on that, that's the kiss of death. So if you give me a real choice, I will ask for Pat Robertson. Wait, I forgot which one. Well, let me go there and then you.
Beyond any kind of negotiation. Obviously, the negotiation with the PLO is inevitable. Question how we get there, but beyond that, can you specify what kind of Israel you see that is acceptable, or is that all a relevant question?
Look, we're not in a position to dictate the internal content of the cultural setup of Israel. I might have my own personal views about the whole spectrum of what constitutes a culture and all that, but that becomes more an academic, and I'm willing to do it. At this moment, our ambitions are not that high. What we want is for the Palestinians to have their own identity and peoplehood respected, and I think that if there is respect for peace, it generates its own values. I mean, you have within the Israeli body politic people who are as indignant as I am when Mr. Shamir calls Palestinians grasshoppers. They're equally indignant. I prefer them. I mean, the other one scares me. I mean, talking about fears, I mean, this is not fear, this is scaring. And so the political culture is predicated on certain basic values. If it is values of human integration, if it's values which are egalitarian, naturally they will be more sensitized to the urge for egalitarianism among the Palestinians or among the Arabs in general. And, I mean, there is a problem. He raised a very, very important problem. I mean, there is 17% of the population of Israel are Arabs. And when the uprising took place, they articulated solidarity. Did they articulate solidarity because they were made to feel alienated with some veneer of improvements? Were they made to feel that they belong, or they had to insist on living in Nazareth, or living in the Galilee, and protecting themselves against the influx of denying them equality? It's very important. So there are many issues of the type of political culture you're asking is also something within the internal Israeli body politic. We have our own, all sorts of, but as I said, and this is crucial, we have problems of discrimination. We have problems of alienation in the Arab world. Any Arab who tells you, oh no, we're fine and everything, it's not true. We have them every day. But to us, they are problems. We are worried that discrimination against non-Jews is a policy, not a problem. If it's a problem, it will be dealt with. But if it's a policy, it has to be confronted. That is the difference in political culture. If I come to you today and say, like some people in Lebanon, said, we want to build a Christian state, or in a pluralistic society like Lebanon, a Muslim state. That's wrong. Because it becomes inherently discriminatory by definition. Now you might say that Christians or Jews or Muslims have a particularity that they want to protect. Okay, there might be reasonableness for some autonomies, cultural autonomy, etc. Like there should be for the Kurds, there should be for the Armenians in our midst. I mean, culture, ethnicity or cultural ethnicity can be legitimate in the search of an egalitarian society. But if ethnicity becomes exclusionary of equal rights in a pluralistic society, then it becomes racist. And then it's not legitimate anymore. We must make these, and we can no longer treat Israel as an exception to the rules. It has to. Israel says, some Americans here in the United States says, well, I mean, when they want to become charitable towards us, they say, and we measure Israel by higher standards. Why? Neither higher nor lower. Same standards. I mean, this patronizing attitude, as if Israel, even when it's doing wrong, has to be measured by a superior standard. Why? That is the built-in contempt, maybe not consciously, unconsciously, against third world peoples. You expect the projectors of a Western world inside the third world, because Israel, in the final analysis, is the ultimate vengeance that the West has against the third world, which decolonized itself. It's the only successful enterprise. That is why you get somebody like Senator Helms supporting it, and the guilt complex gets somebody like Senator Kennedy silenced, and you'd hear no more any voice of dissent or criticism.
Mentioned before the Iran-Iraq conflict, you didn't really elaborate on it. You also mentioned repeatedly terms such as moral imperative, justice. My understanding of what's happening to the Kurdish people in Iraq by the Iraqi government, and also the atrocities that are going on in the Iran-Iraq war, and the fact that the United Nations has said very little about this in proportion to what's been said about problems that go on between Israel and Palestinians. Why is this, which seems to me an issue which is central to all Arab peoples, when there are two Arab nations that are killing each other, why is this put in the back seat as opposed to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, first of all, as you know, Iran is not an Arab state, but it is. But Iran has many historical and geographical and spiritual bonds with the Arab world, and to that extent, we have always considered the Iran-Iraq conflict to be basically a dispute. Neither Iran has removed the Arabs from their homes and dispossessed them, nor does Iraq want to remove. So it remained within the war of disputes, not the wars of seeking destiny. It's an unfortunate war. It's a war which should never have continued this long. It's a war of intransigence. It's a war that has debilitated the economic potential of these two societies and countries. It's a war whereby ideological hegemony is sought to be imposed and therefore resisted. That explains its continuation. It's a war which we want to end, because I have many reasons to explain about this war. We in the Arab world supported the Islamic Revolution in Iran, because it rid Iran not only from a dictator in his own country, but it rid a dead weight on us, on the Arab world, and we found in the Iranian Revolution an exemplary removal of a very dead weight. And we wanted this to to be the interaction. It's a sort, we thought at the beginning that it was like in India, Gandhi, Khomeini, and the democratic forces of Barisadra, sort of Nehru. Well, it was not the same, unfortunately. We thought, we injected our own wishful thinking into it because we related to that development, historically, spiritually, the sort of Islamic Renaissance. But there is a fundamental difference between fundamentalism and obscurantism. And when the obscurantist features became more visible, we began to seek that these are two states that must settle. We supported the 598, the resolution of Security Council. 5 months the superpowers worked on it, and now we are supporting it. We support the Secretary General's plan. Iraq has accepted it. In Iran there is an internal debate about it. They had an elections. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to be settled readily. But I think next week it's going to be the plan of implementation. It is what you might call a dispute that has gone eerie. While with Israel, it is a conflict which must be resolved, hopefully peacefully. So it's one is a conflict, one is a dispute. But that doesn't mean that it has not assumed bloody dimensions, which are so, so damaging and so unnecessary.
The question that was in there that I still haven't quite heard the answer I was looking for is that why is there not the moral outrage of the killing of the Kurdish people by poisonous gas in the thousands? Why is this not being...
Well, there is moral outrage. Who said there isn't? There is moral outrage about not only on that particular killing, on the continuation of the killing. I mean, this is an unnecessary hemorrhage between people who are not supposed to have ambitions on each other. This is a conflict which is so unnecessary and which has been fueled through the Iran gate because they didn't want it to be settled. That was one other factor, unfortunately. But as far as the Arabs are concerned, the Kurds, you're talking about the Kurds. There are Kurds in Syria, there are Kurds in Iraq, there are Kurds in Iran, there are Kurds in the Soviet Union, there are Kurds in Turkey. Now, you can reasonably say, why does that not emerge into a Kurdish nation? That is different. But as long as they are part of the Arab world, they should be entitled to total equality, to human dignity, and to their linguistic and cultural autonomy. But if at a subsequent historical stage, when the whole geopolitics of the region are transformed, then the Kurds of Iran and Iraq and Turkey and Syria and want to form a nation, that becomes a different matter. I think they too, like the Palestinians, in a way, had to reconcile, but not necessarily compromise. So I am not rendering a moral judgment on the question. I think that any attempt to continue this war is wrong because it is unnecessary and because it is between people that have more bonds between them than differences, irrespective of the fact that they are two nationalities. They have so many spiritual bonds, which sometimes I get so angry and I say, Islam is so authentic, but the Muslims are in deep, deep crisis. And this is unfortunate. And maybe we made an appeal on Ramadan, maybe they will just calm down this unnecessary and unfortunate war. Anyhow, not everything is rational and not everything is humanist. That's why we have our problems and platforms and conflicts, but should not disable us from expanding the area of human rationality and reasonableness.
Okay, I think we really have to be on time because you might not believe it.